Don't worry, this is the power of editing afterwards. It's all going to Audacity.
You'll be replaced by voice actors.
Oh, yeah. I'll be played by Matt
Mercer.
Matt Mercer, yeah. He's got much better hair than I have.
Mr. Timothy.
Probably a bit of everything than I have.
Hi, this is Steve, a.k.a. at AllAnthar on Twitter, and here are some more of my gaming vexes. Joined by Andrew, Kat and Rick to talk about a recent series of games we played using the Verm RPG rules. Published by Nocturnal Media and now distributed by Chaosium, Verm is the name of the last great ice age to sweep across Europe. It's set in the prehistory of humanity, deep in the European Ice Age, 35,000 years ago. In these long forgotten times, powerful beasts roamed a territory covered in steppes and taiga, from the snow-covered mountains to the roaring sea. Mammoths, aurochs, bison, giant deer and cave lions. Two species of humans lived amongst these giant creatures in small hunter-gatherer communities, the Neanderthal and the Cro-Magnon. In the game, you play as members of one of these tribes of humans, ranging across the Ice Age tundra of Europe, trying to survive and thrive in a hostile environment. Our series of games focus on a small band of hunter-gatherers, the Black River people, who make their home in what will become known as the Swabian Jura in the Ach Valley. The valleys here have produced some of the earliest pieces of mobile art known, including the earliest known flute. I've included a link to a YouTube video showing some of these finds in the show notes. Our story begins as a band of hunters return from a foraging trip in the high valleys. As they descend, they find the form of Laoki, one of their clan and the father of one of the characters, face down in a mountain pool. As they drag him from the water, it's obvious he's been attacked by a cave lion, one of the apex predators of their world. Mysteriously, Laoki is holding a necklace made from mountain lion teeth, and the characters know that no one in their clan has such a rare item. On return to their clan, the elders are worried. A prowling cave lion is a threat to all. Moreover, the only person with the skill to make such a necklace belongs to another clan, one Akomi of the people of the Singing Stones. But they've been estranged from the Black River people since a hunting trip ended in tragedy many seasons before. Perhaps the estranged clan have decided to take their revenge by cursing the Black River people, but why now? And why is the necklace of teeth in Laoki's possession? Whilst the elders decided what to do, our hunters set out to kill or drive off the cave lion, which they do at some cost. On their return, the elders inform they must travel to the clan of the Singing Stones and determine the truth of the mystery. Laoki remains at the brink of death despite all of the healing skill of the clan, as though his spirit is being tormented. The hunters set off into the high passes, encountering deadly cold and what appears to be the spirit of a cave lion stalking them. Yet, through bravery and skill, they find the Singing Stone people, drawn by the haunting sound of a flute. After some reticence, the hunters are welcomed to the clan's fires and the mystery unfolds. The necklace was indeed Akomi's. It had been buried with him some months beforehand. Laoki was a grave robber, an unforgivable sin. To atone for their clanmate's wrongdoing, the Singing Stone Elders charge the hunters with obtaining the skull of a cave bear to lay to rest with Akomi. This the heroes do, again at some cost. Moreover, the hunters participate in a successful hunt with the Singing Stone clan, laying to rest all the bitterness of the past many seasons. In triumph, the hunters return to their home clan, bringing with them a delegation from the people of Singing Stones. Following a tearful reunion, the clans convene to decide on Laoki's fate. Although he recovered physically from the time that Akomi's spirit was laid to rest, Laoki would be treated as though he had in fact died and be cast out, a certain death sentence. In this time, the clan is all, and you're only as strong as your relationships with those around you.
first of all, thanks for offering to talk through our experiences doing the Worm Game. Do you want to just introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Kat. I'm at Mayor for Beer on Twitter. I played Amek, who was our slightly shy young trapper. Very much a tribe-orientated young man. He fully understood the chances of survival were very little without your tribe, so he was fully on supporting them throughout the whole adventure in various ways.
So I'm Rick Knotts, at Lintillers on Twitter, and I played Winali, who was, well, basically Granny Weatherwax. We're talking about her. Granny Weatherwax with a hangover. So she was a shaman, respected elder in the tribe, and yeah, a bit of a personality, I think.
to say the least.
I'm Andrew. I can be found on Twitter at Zos93. I played Sixthis, who was a herbalist and healer. Very person-orientated. It was all about building relationships, keeping things calm and together.
Okay, so it's not a review, but I think it's an interesting opportunity to talk about gaming in historical versus pseudo-historical settings. Because certainly the way I was seeing Verm and got really interested in the book, just the whole concept, it was trying to locate it as firmly as possible in a historical setting. But that's got some limitations to go with it. But I suppose the first question is, what's the attraction of gaming in one of these historical or pseudo-historical settings?
I think for me, the great thing about Worm and the way it's set up, particularly the world and the artwork, really draws you into it, is that storytelling aspect that you see when you go to exhibitions on that period of time. They do talk about how they stories sort of shape their world. Mm-hmm. And what I did like about this game, it was really quite easy to drop into that and kind of explore the world, because, you know, it's very easy for, you know, us to go, right, you know, you need to go and hunt the cave lion. Brilliant. We're going to get some high caliber bullets and we're going to be nowhere near it. Whereas with them, because you're straight away with your little spear, which is not a
which
great
has got game. A chance of breaking if you do any damage.
Yeah.
And they
did. Indeed. Every time you do damage to it, it would break. It's really easy to get yourself into that mindset of how they must have felt, that really careful planning, and then also that slightly gung-ho thing of, you know, it's going well, let's just do it. You know, that's the kind of appeal to it. Unlike, like some of the other games, you sort of build up levels. Yeah. Within Worm, you don't. Instead, you develop your character through experience, so you have to do stuff, which... Mm-hmm. I think that would help you fall into that mindset that you need for this game.
Have you played historical games before?
Yeah, I've got... It's a smaller booklet game. I can't remember what it's actually called. It's a Viking one. You are basically playing Vikings. Normally, they recommend it's when you're setting out to form a new village. Okay. So you're going out in the world. So it's kind of similar, although I must admit, I think Worm has its charm in the fact it is slightly simpler. Mm. It's got a much more looser game setting, so you can sort of hang your bits onto it a lot easier, and it doesn't feel quite as constricted as, say, the Viking Age did. You could go out voyaging, adventuring, getting treasure, to be fair, raiding places, but here you've got, you know, it is a lot more simpler, but yeah, on the other hand, there's a lot more scope for imagination.
Yeah, it's a much broader campus, isn't it, I suppose?
I think, talking about story, Kat mentioned storytelling, I actually think that's one of the things that historical games do encourage. I find it easier to get into the actual role play in a historical setting, maybe because there isn't the opportunity to go down the kind of murder hobo kind of dice rolling route. And your actions do have consequences. It's one of the things a good GM can do in a fantasy setting, but it is easier in a historical setting.
You know, I want to be upfront. I struggled a bit with Worm, generally. I mean, I came into it really excited. And, I mean, you guys are brilliant players. And, you know, what do you do in the world? I mean, talking about that Viking one.
Yeah.
So you've got social structures there. You've got a much broader world, you know, a much wider range of activities.
I think with the Viking one also, we know a lot more about them because there's a lot more written stuff from them. There's a lot more third party stuff in, for example, you know, the monastery certainly wrote about them.
You can just watch The Last Kingdom, so there's a lot more, for example.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot more stuff about them, so we know a lot more. Whereas within Worm, there is that slightly uncomfortable thing of you are putting yourself into the position of somebody in the Ice Age, but you don't really know that much about them. I mean, we've got little bits from them. I mean, I know you did a great deal of research, particularly in the area we were in, and the artifacts that have been found, but we don't know anything about these people.
I was thinking that it's looser, but it does give you quite a lot of space if there's sort of nothing that's really known about this, then you can make stuff up. You can riff to an extent. So, I mean, but I think, to be honest, the game really does depend on you really liking the setting. You've got to be very into it. I mean, it puts its cards right on the table just with a name. Boom, it's not sort of paleomythic, but it's the name of a glacial period.
Yep.
I mean, that doesn't really, that's not a connection I think you'd probably make unless you really were interested in this particular time. So I think it depends upon quite a lot of buy-in. It assumes, I think, quite a lot of knowledge on the part of the players.
I mean, it is very much cards on the table. So although it's a game, I mean, it's clearly a game. It's not trying to be a simulation of living in the Worm glaciation, because, you know, how could you? But it's quite clear, actually, you know, it's trying to locate it very specifically in this area. It talks a lot about the different cultures and the technologies, you know, and that sort of thing. But if we're attracted to historical games, what is it we're trying to, what's the aim? Are we trying to get a window into a world, you know, an experience or just a view of what it might have been like? Or are we there for like the Easter eggs? Because obviously I built in, you know, the Easter eggs in terms of the finds in that particular geographical area.
I think for me, as I said, the idea of trying to put yourself into a position of somebody who's standing at, you know, in the ice age is quite good. But the one thing I quite like about this game, why these sort of historical games do kind of appeal, and it's the slight appeal of the Viking game as well, is the fact that this is a really collaborative game. You know, none of your characters are going to survive if they bugger off on their own. You know, as a hunter, if my character just thought, no, you know what, I can manage without you guys, I'm off, he would die quite quickly, eventually, because he's got no one to care for him. He's got no, you know, he's going to have no defense against any bigger predators, because that's where our big success is as humans, is we're a group. We're a group of monkeys that will defend each other. You know, and that is kind of what the Ice Age would bring about. You know, you would end up being a far tighter group. Everyone would have a role. There's no space for a princess. Whereas a lot of other games, when you play them, you know, for example, the Game of Thrones RPG.
Yes, yeah.
You know, that is, okay, it's not quite a historical game because obviously it's still a fantasy game. But you are kind of encouraged to get ahead of everybody else and kind of screw every other player if you can.
But that's built into the setting, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is. But this is where I think Worm and a couple of the others do differ with the historical approach. They actually show the collaborative side of humanity, which I quite like.
Yeah, you couldn't be a thief class in this game, could you? Because be kicked out of the tribe. And
exactly.
I mean, we saw that, you know, with Laoki getting essentially exiled and became a living ghost at the end. Which, you know, they say that's a death sentence, and was in those sort of cultures, and, you know, has been up to the present day, I think.
Yeah, definitely. With the, I think, you know, okay, we don't know what they did to kick somebody out of the tribe, but I do feel that your version of them doing a funeral would probably be the closest to it. I feel kind of. I mean, there are kind of semi untouched people still in the world, but even, you know, the smallest amount of contact with the Western world, and that gets corrupted really, really quickly. I mean, the nice thing about this was also with the supernatural when it came in, was how quick and easy it was. Even though I'm kind of playing this game, knowing, you're pitting us against the lion, it's very easy for you to suddenly start thinking as that character that, no, this is something more, just with a few hints, and having a shaman with you tends to make you feel that there's something going on anyway.
Well, I thought, for me, it's what you actually said. It is, in respect of kind of collaborative and things, it's quite a nice sort of gentle game, because you know really that although obviously there are challenges, you kind of have a idea of what those challenges are, and you know that you're going to be helped in those challenges as well. It's not like you have to watch your back as such. You know, you've always got you've always kind of got someone on your, as you say, it's a very collaborative kind of game, you know, so it's not like, you know, say D&D, where, you know, one of the players may well be plotting to stab you in the back.
You couldn't have one of those players, you know, you couldn't have that guy. You talked about the role of realism versus sort of pseudo-realism. I don't think any historical game will, you know, unless you're really trying to replicate the experience, will sort of have a on a continuum in that respect. And in this game. So magic and spiritualism. So what was your expectation, I think, going into the game? And what was your experience in the game? What did that feel like?
I think it worked in the game. It sort of worked functionally. It felt right. I don't know if it actually was, but I got the feeling that it needed to be there. Without it, then it would have been really quite hollow, and it would have been sort of the story of quite a few fishing trips.
Yes. Yeah.
Essentially, because it would have been a role-playing game with mainly about the grinding struggle for survival.
Yes.
And there's not, you can't really do very much with that.
No.
But if you've actually got that other layer on it, and I suppose, well, maybe not the sort of seeing visions and so on, you could argue that, but I think for the idea of social cohesion, that will be such a central part of these people's lives. So in that case, it would be perfectly appropriate to have it there and have it in quite sort of front and center.
I like the storytelling aspect of the magic in a way, because as I said, we are kind of all linked by our own stories, and particularly when your character was doing the ritual in the cave, when we brought back the cave lion skull as part of our trying to strengthen things. I, in a way, that did bring everyone's characters quite together. You know, okay, we went out and hunted the thing. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely one thing. But going through the whole circle of it was quite an important part of the game, I felt, personally.
I also thought that mechanically, I don't know how it works in the book, but I thought you modelled it quite well in terms of what the actual rituals would achieve, in that you gave us kind of a one or two bonus on certain skills, which, you know, effectively, I think, you know, given you took about historical setting, works quite well, because effectively it is a kind of psych up, you know, it's you know, you're told the gods are with you, you know, so immediately you go and feel better.
Yeah.
You know, you've got more chance of stabbing that lion, of climbing that rock, of
feel as though things are on your side. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's the positive thinking thing. So I think mechanically you actually modelled it quite well. So it came across as realistic as kind of magic and spiritualism can, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I mean, what I didn't want it to be was you know, magic spells and fireballs.
Exactly,
and,
yeah.
You know, lightning bolts. Coming back to Rick's point, I think if you didn't have that in the game, I think it would lose some of that richness.
Yeah.
But, and actually, we'll talk more a little bit about character creation, but it's very much about you have the strength of certain animals. And so your characters are allied with particular animals which bring particular strengths, which give you particular skills. So the whole thing is sort of set up in that way. So it's almost as though, although it gives you the option to have no magic setting, it would be quite a lot the poorer for that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I mean, it's noticeable because it's got also rules for sort of semi-mythical creatures as well.
Yeah.
Kind of optional. But the fact that, you know, they actually decided to actually put it in there tells you something, doesn't it? That,
definitely.
It's actually really important, and it's not going to work without it.
In a game like this, I struggle a little bit with what to do. So as you say, Rick, essentially it's hunting, fishing, it's talking to people. It's, you know, craft activities. Talking to people and hunting and fishing have got some role play crunch behind them. Crafting, not so much. I struggle a little bit. What you do? I mean, in Paleomythic, for example, I mean, obviously drawing some comparisons with that, they have, you know, sort of the ancient lands of Mu, and they've got these sort of, you know, sorcerer priests and this sort of thing, as I understand it. So you've got a bit more...
More like a traditional role-playing game.
Yeah, you've got something you can get your hooks into in terms of actual, you know, conflict and whatever.
Yeah, this is where I do feel with Worm, the longevity of a campaign is going to be quite difficult. As I said, you with the hunting gathering, there is a little bit of crunch, but there has come a point of how far can you go? I mean, I suppose there is, you know, there could be scope for a game where the tribe's got too big that you need to split off because there's not enough food in that area, or even just tracking down a mammoth or something. So you're going to have to head away from home to go and get one of those. You know, there's also those sort of things. So without the supernatural putting an overlay, I am curious as to how far you'd kind of go. I mean, I suppose there have been recorded of the level of fighting because of the damage on some of the bones, etc. Yeah. But, you know, are you, how often would you be attacked? I mean, would you be attacked by, as I said, the other grouping, the other humans in the world?
Neanderthals.
in the finals? Yeah. Would they or wouldn't they? You know, we don't know how they actually reacted really to each other, to be honest.
There would only really be competition for resources, I think, as long as there was enough resources.
There were so few humans around
I think for me, I think you couldn't do an extended campaign of it. But going back to what I said about it being gentle, that's actually quite good. I think for sort of 6 or 8 weeks, kind of a sort of gentle break from your traditional kind of role-playing games.
Smash actually, stuff up, loot the bodies.
Loot the bodies, exactly, yeah. It's actually quite nice.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, but I found it quite intimate. Because you are actually, I think it's one of those ones where it does benefit if you only got a few characters, smaller number. Because it's kind of, like, I guess, kind of in the tribe, you'd be in each other's pockets the whole time. Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I was very aware of this. So although I didn't have portraits for all of the characters in the tribe, I mean, I tried to sort of show some of the social interactions. I think that comes to the fore. And a lot of the strengths, the traits that the characters have talk about those social interactions. Something's just occurred to me, actually. I think you're right. If with the same set of characters, I think it would be quite difficult to have a multi-series campaign. But I think what you could do is almost revisit a group of humans over the course of several hundred years, do you know what I mean? Or thousands of years, and do it that way. So it's almost like you're the ancestors. You know, in the first game, your characters become the ancestors, and then they are watching the activities and maybe inhabit the bodies as you move through the rise of you know modern humans in Europe. I mean, it's almost like a birthright campaign from old AD&D, isn't it, really? I mean, the book doesn't talk about that, but that could give you that sort of investment in the characters, I think, maybe.
Yeah, so maybe like the actual character becomes the tribe.
Yeah, so it'd be like troop style play, wouldn't it? Really? Yeah. I think it'd be quite a challenge to play and to run that sort of thing. But I think that'd be more feasible than a, as you say, a sort of multi-series campaign with the same characters.
Yeah, I don't think you could play this for like a couple of years like we have of Inquest, you know?
No. I mean, you know, your actual activities are fairly limited, aren't they? Having said all that, I mean, what do you think about the actual game itself in terms of the concepts and the style and the artwork? Do you think it brings those through effectively?
Yeah, I do. I must admit, I think the artwork is actually really well picked, to be honest. I mean,
we did have
a bit of a laugh about a couple of the pictures, but to be fair, given, I mean, I don't know if anyone else remembers it, the Mongoose Conan the Barbarian, which was far more, oh my God, it's been drawn by a 14-year-old boy. This was more, you know, it was two pictures that you could go, really, but be fair, in the context of the rest of the art, it actually kind of does fit in. It's not actually that bad.
I think the
artwork and the style of writing, and to be fair, the person who translated, let's give that person a lot of kudos as well, because they've done a fantastic job of translating another language, particularly for the book. I know we did laugh about one of the medical terms, which turned out was more of a French term for a poultice.
Cataplasm. But, that's a word I will never forget now. Cataplasm, it's a good one.
But I do feel, I think the book really did a lovely job of actually setting the game well from the moment of first starting reading it, to be fair. So I really liked it.
Yeah, I really liked it.
Yeah.
I mean, I particularly like the fact there's definitely a fanboy element in it.
Yeah.
I forget which chapter that it starts, when it starts talking about sort of, right, and this is what the Neolithic was like. There's a lot of enthusiasm in there.
Yes.
I found that carried me along, actually.
He's an actor. He's obviously done quite a lot of research and a lot of thinking about it, you know, and you could tell with, you know, the different types of tools that are available to different cultures. And, you know, this would be available to the Neanderthal, but not available to Cro-Magnon man and, you know, or the long folk and the bear folk, as it was called in the book. But yeah, you could tell that it was a real act. There was a lot of love in that.
Yet they managed to do it without making it overtly academic, which is because there's nothing worse than kind of, you know, the rule book that reads like an academic textbook. And, you know, and they managed to keep away from that, which is great. You know, it was a really engaging overview of the Neolithic period, you know.
Definitely, yeah. What about the rules themselves? I mean, again, you know, it's not a review as such. I suppose it's just a reflection on what we thought about it. Were there any even better ifs or any bits that sort of stood out for us in terms of the rules? I mean, the character creation itself, what was What did that feel like from your perspective? I think quick is a word that's
I'm going to say, yeah, quick. And it's quite nice. It's, I don't know about anyone else, but given, you know, the last character previously I was sorting out was a Pathfinder character. Wow. It's so lovely to have a character concept of Amex, the trapper hunter, and being able to pretty much wrap it up within 10 minutes and go, ha-ha, I've got him. And it was beautifully done. You know, there was no trying to weigh up 15 different feats, which one do I pick? You know, it was really quite elegant, to be fair.
Yeah, because I mean, the way that the rules work, just for the benefit of people listening to this, it's 2d6 versus the target number. Well, you started with 2d6, and then if you have a relevant strength, what was Sickus's strength of it? Was it?
I think he had Venom of the Viper, which helped him in making potions and poultices. And
yeah, so you'd add an extra d6 if you had strength. Add an extra d6,
anything involving kind of herbalism,
Yeah, so it's pretty open as far as that goes, and you selected, as you say, a number of strengths that go with that. But so it's pretty quick.
Yeah, and I love the fact that, as I say, within those rules and those little sections, there's wriggle room to be able to try and bargain. Can I have this, please? Because I have been doing this type thing. Because it does, the ambiguity is sort of like, as long as you're role-playing it, you can kind of do a slight argument, which is quite nice. I like that kind of give and take in a system.
I think what I would say, if Chaos Humor are going to be doing another edition, I'd overhaul the Shaman rules, definitely.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you were the only person where the rules were a little bit more of a problematic thing, wasn't it, for your character?
Yeah, I actually had a normal starting out Shaman as the first character. It's an absolute waste of space. Sap fan, Lord, God love him, but he was, because he was just starting out, literally he could not do anything.
Yeah.
Really couldn't.
Yeah.
So we decided to do something with Wenali simply because, to try out the Shaman rules. Huge fun, but it takes a long time to get to that level before it's even useful. And one thing that does actually, I guess, fit in with the background is you need to earn your keep while you're in this context.
Yeah, I must admit that was why when we were facing the challenge of getting a bear skull, that was part of my character's thing of, could Wenali actually help me, and Sickus, to be fair, could they help me bring down a cave bear? Was kind of going, no, she was great for getting the spirits on our side, but I can't pitch her against that. I've got to find another way, which is when I came up with the idea of let's have a look and see if we can find a skull. Yeah. You know, there is no way that Wenali, pitch her in a battle against another shaman. She can do that to the cows come home, but you know, anything physical, because by that stage you're so old, you can't, you know, I mean, I'd love to have seen her stomp up to this confused bear, whack it on the nose with her stick and to die.
Oh, don't tempt. She probably reckoned she could it.
I think in some ways the Shaman rules are a bit of a victim of the kind of historical game, in that they realise they've got to have them in there, but they're not entirely sure how to model them within the context of a historical system. I mean, otherwise, I thought the system suited the game really well. You didn't want anything too complicated for a game where your options are, you know, hunting and fishing.
I think more reflections. Yeah, no, I agree. I think more reflections on it are that starting characters they're not very capable. I mean, you've got the 2d6 roll, but there's not a lot to differentiate. I mean, that's probably a little bit unfair. I mean, you've got a lot of strengths and weaknesses in there, so you can, you know, make your characters unique, but you don't start off with a lot. And so obviously that's shown with the Shaman, the spiritual character. But I think also the experience rules, they're not well defined. I mean, we didn't really get to the point where we were going to have experience as such. I mean, you had points you could use for additional D6 to roll that you sort of, you know, almost like mana points that you spent in the session. But, you know, I was starting to come up with the idea of thinking, well, how could you learn new strengths? How would that work in play? And it's almost like the rules have gone so far, and it feels like the rules have been used for a home game that have been written up, but not developed to the point, and probably possibly not widely playtested.
I think that is probably symptomatic of the fact that it's very difficult to have a long campaign in this game. And I think that's why they're not so well defined, because I think it happens so rarely, because this would be difficult to as we have discussed, it'd be very difficult to do a long campaign. And I think that's possibly why. I don't think really that many people will get to the stage of running this for years because it's a difficult one. And to be fair, your character could die at any moment, literally, if you're really unlucky.
I think in terms of the Shaymin rules, going back to the realism angle, you know, that is fairly realistic. You know, an old Shaymin would be very powerful, but a new Shaymin, you know, wouldn't. In terms of the experience, I guess if you were going to kind of expand it, you could probably use the Shaymin rules to that effect, you know, where the... If you want to learn a new skill, say centered the badger or something, you know, then the shaman,
strength of the shrew,
exactly, yeah. then the shaman summons the spirit of that animal,
yeah,
you know, and you could work some sort of rules in like that.
You could come up with something, and that's for people like us. That would be easy to do, but I think, I mean, I don't think, you know, we enjoyed it. It's good fun. It's, you know, it suits how the background is portrayed very, very well. I don't think it's a beginner's game. I think if somebody just picked this up,
I think
they would struggle with it.
It's not D&D 5, is it?
No, it's not. And I think Chaosium, they're not doing a second edition. I think they are just distributing really. So it'll be pretty much as is. I think that's just something to people to be aware of, really. Character creation with experience talked about. I mean, combat. There's a lot of rules around the combat section, isn't there? Yeah. Which I don't think we really got into that much.
No, we didn't. It's certainly lethal, though. I think the best comparison for me is like RuneQuest, to be honest, to a certain point. It's at this level, if you don't have armor, it's very painful. It's extremely painful quite quickly. If you're just unlucky, you know, if my dice rolls are crap, the lions are better. I end up with an interesting scar. If not, I'm really damaged as well. Yeah. So it's quite a lethal combat.
Although the healing rules are fairly forgiving, weren't they?
They were, There's quite a lot of sort of you can make a sort of poultice or whatever with it, and you get a few points back.
I think, you know, the lethality of combat is realistic in that, you know, going up against a mountain lion, you will probably have to be lucky, you know. But so I think in that respect, you know, I think it's not a bad thing in keeping with the realistic aspects of the game. And I think the healing rules are maybe their attempt at realising that it is supposed to be a game. You know, somebody, their character, you know, gets trampled by an elk or something, you know, on the first hunting trip is not...
Yeah,
you know,
that can happen, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's probably an attempt to introduce a kind of, you know, yes, we realise it's a game to what is, as you say, overall a historical simulation system.
If one of us got gored by an elk or something, we'd be out of commission, if not dead. We'd be out of commission for months. And so from a game perspective, as you say, that's probably a bit of a nod to that, which, you know, again, which makes sense. No one wants their characters dying. I mean, it's not OSR. Is it, for heaven's sake?
No. I mean, the only way you can get around that is what we talked about earlier with a sort of troop play, you know, where people basically have an entire tribe, you know, it's like, oops, hunter dead. Here comes another hunter, you know.
That's got challenges in terms of your, because I think, you know, we all as players engage with our character.
Exactly.
And I think if you realise you've got sort of five or six in the shoot, you know, it becomes like playing paranoia then, doesn't it?
It does a bit, yeah.
Hunter number six.
I must admit, I don't kind of like the idea of troop playing, because as I said, it is very much, it does become a, oh, well, he's dead. I'm going to parachute in this one. And it's like, really? I must admit, paranoia, for all its intents and purposes, with your clones, is a little bit more fun.
It's a comedy game, isn't it?
It is a comedy game. But with this, if you keep on parachuting and other members of the tribe, it's going to feel very much like a very cold war game eventually, which would lose its charm.
Definitely.
Paranoia also suffers from the same thing this suffers from, which is you can't really do an extended campaign of it. You know, paranoia is fun for a couple of sessions, but, you know, it's not a game you play for a year.
No, I think that's it. I think this is one of those games that's probably very well suited to, you know, either, you know, one shots or a short series, possibly sort of an episodic series where you have, as you know, we talked about, you're actually playing the tribe rather than the individuals.
I must admit, with the feel good factor of this game, because I don't think there was ever a session I walked away from it and I felt frustrated or, you know, on it. Every single time I walked away from it feeling quite good, because we've kind of achieved something. I felt really good about it. It's a great game.
Feel happy when they walk away. Although Andrew might disagree.
I always enjoy having questions. session.
I'm pulling your leg.
But, you know, in a way, this game would be perfect if you wanted a game every couple of sessions as a decompress.
Like a palate cleanser.
You know, for your
it's
group.
A really gentle game, yeah. Is what I said. You know, it's a lovely, gentle, really enjoyable game.
It can't be any kind of mistake or misadventure that it's actually got rules for playing as kids.
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, there's clearly that's a side of it. They thought, you know, it could be used like this.
It's part of the character. Which what makes me think it's a home game that's been transported into. Yeah.
And it doesn't, those sort of rules don't really fit in with the rest.
No.
Although it would be quite a good game for kids to play if they were learning about history.
You know,
the attention of trying to put yourself in someone's shoes type history. I mean, obviously there are very few parts of history where you can do that with kids without worrying, you know, because you certainly don't want to do a civil war, because the next thing you know, in the playground, one of them's twatted the other one with a wooden stick or something. Whereas with this game, hopefully they wouldn't be doing
that.
So, but it would be a great sort of tool for, you know, for history learning for kids. I agree, the kids' rules were a bit weird.
But I think that's what it's been used for. Because the guy who wrote it, he'd illustrated a lot of museum displays in France, and that's where it happened. So I think he'd used them as teaching aids to teach kids. So I think that's
sense,
right.
Yeah.
Are there any even better ifs as far as the rules go?
I think they work. As I said, I think if you can have a shame character, they've got to be older. Got to have an actual shame as opposed to an apprentice shame.
Yeah, I did feel a bit sorry for Satpan.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, I mean... It was work experience shaming. But yeah, you would have to do that. I'd definitely start shamans with a little higher up than they've currently got.
But we just loaded you with all the physical difficulties as well, didn't we? We sort of glossed over that. I mean, the party was travelling over the mountains to the Valley of the Singing Stones. I thought, blimey, normally Vinali would be dead in a ditch.
Not with an evil spirit prowling around, we'll keep her alive if I had the carrier.
I mean, to be honest, that was the bit I really enjoyed. One of the best bits was actually that journey. There was a feeling of genuine sort of brooding menace around the whole thing. And it did feel like, yeah, I can die at any moment on this.
It was interesting, actually, with that one, with particularly the night descriptions of this thing prowling around outside, how actually everyone kind of ended up huddled around Rinali.
Yeah.
Not to protect her, but more because she was protecting them, which is really weird considering you were a little old lady who smells a bit funny, to be fair, just was very grumpy. And the fact that we were actually looking to you to protect us rather than the other way around was quite interesting, because I did think that after the session that we just had to leave it, I think, and I was like thinking, blimey, yeah, I would never have thought, but, you know, it was interesting how the situation switches.
Yeah. It was one of the nicest. Oh, yeah, I did like that bit.
It was good fun. So touching on our game, you know, I'm interested in, you know, the Ice Age, you know, the Upper Paleolithic and that whole start of modern human culture. What I wanted to do was to try and locate it somewhere real, placing it in those two valleys where they found, you know, the earliest flute and where they found some of the earliest mobile art. And I really wanted to locate it in as much of a historical or real setting as possible. And, I felt pleased the way that came out, because obviously it meant that it was almost like some Easter eggs that I'd put in the game, and it was like, ta-da, look. But from your perspective, I mean, did we achieve what we wanted out of the game, do you think?
I love the idea that it is possible. Maybe that was how those items ended up where they did. We don't know. My interest in this sort of era of time is the storytelling, the cave art, and how we think that stories have evolved and changed, in a way, changed humanity as well. And I love that kind of aspect. We've told our own version of this story, even though we don't know what happened. Yeah. And it is actually perfectly plausible. Because let's face it, it wasn't an Amazon delivery that delivered that statue over there.
That's the thing. I mean, it was a historical simulationist game, but it felt real. It actually, you know, there was at no point did that, as Kat said, feel like it couldn't have happened in the Neolithic.
I mean, that was in terms of the magic. I quite like the fact there's the series The Winter King by Bernard Cornwell.
Yes.
And there's one bit of it, because Merlin's a character, where they say, where the main narrator says he never did anything that couldn't be explained by normal means.
Yeah,
exactly.
So all the magic could have been explained by, you know, normal bit, normal part of the world. And I think that kind of works with this.
Yeah, it does.
Just about.
It's what I said earlier. Things like, you know, blessings and stuff from the shaman give you that kind of feeling that you can achieve something. It's psychosomatic magic, you know, effectively, you know. So I can go out and beat this lion because the shaman's said that the spirit of the lion is with me type thing, you know.
You could cross the line into actually having, because some of the shaman powers are you actually turn into a human animal, you know, which you could explain away in terms of hallucinogenics, and there was a lot of that in the game as well.
Yeah, definitely,
you
know,
many mushrooms were consumed by the characters in this game. I was very conscious that I wanted to draw that historical, plausible side rather than the fantastical side.
That even occurred in Viking times. You know, the berserkers were literally guys who, you know, wrapped themselves in a bearskin and could, I think it's probably by some sort of psychotropic that they had the powers and strength of the bear.
Yeah. Well, it's latter-day shamanism, isn't it, in that case? So in terms of the game itself, I mean, I enjoyed running it. It was great fun. I think the way the characters, so obviously, you know, our characters and also Kay's character, Katori as well, meshed really well. I think it's very suitable to a smaller scale, slower paced game. But yeah, any final thoughts from you guys?
I just really liked it. I really enjoyed playing it because sort of the other times I'm sort of playing sort of OSR kind of things, and it's a real change of pace. Like you're saying, for a palate cleanser, that works really well. But for a longer campaign, that might be a bit trickier.
Would you be interested coming back at some point to revisit either those characters or the clan of the Black River people?
I can't come back to Wenali because she's dead. Finally carked it, poor girl.
I'd definitely be interested in playing again for another sort of 6 or 8 weeks, maybe with different characters from the same, you know, maybe they could be the children of the previous characters. Or
Could be. Or a thousand years later. I mean, not much changed in a thousand years.
Exactly.
I mean, we're talking 35,000 years ago. Things change very slowly.
A 6 or 8 week game, you know, once or twice a year, I think it's great. You know, I think it's really...
It's really weird because it's one of those games that... I've played a few games where, you play one lot and you go, that was all right, quite pleasant, but you'd never pick it up again. But this isn't one of those. This is one of those that I would quite happily play again. Obviously, once a good inspiration hits, because as you say, I think we're all in agreement, it's not a campaign game. But I would definitely quite happily play this. The change of pace is lovely. I love the storytelling element. It's just a charming little game. It really is lovely. Which, to be fair, I find quite indicative of French games anyway. I always find they do have that little charm to them.
Have you played Nephilim?
We do have a copy of Nephilim. I've got everything I've issued for it.
I haven't, no. I have played Nomine, which in a way does have its own charm. Being able to play a devil is actually quite hilarious fun, to be honest.
Different atmosphere to this one, though, I think.
This, I definitely would say, is a good strong 8.5 out of 10, which is really good for me, I feel.
That's cool. That's good stuff. All right. Thanks for listening to another exploration of my gaming vexes. If you've got any thoughts you'd like to add to what you've heard here, or a gaming vex of your own you'd like to offer up for discussion, you can contact me on Twitter at AllAnthR, or you can leave a voice message. The link's on the podcast webpage on Anchor, or can be found in the show notes. Until the next time, may all your games be free of vexatiousness, and be excellent to each other, always.